This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
I think I should drink 8 glasses of water, and I drink 4 cups.
I think I should drink about 160 ounces per day, but I actually drink around 120.
I think I should drink about 64 ounces of water each day, and I probably drink half of that.
We know water is essential for life, but are we better people when we're hydrated? It seems advertisers and social media want us to think so.
We're supposed to drink water now. When did that start?
I bought the 5 most popular water bottles.
Okay, so I have 4 emotional support cups, and you want to know what's in them.
Why am I obsessed with the green one?
I have never seen this one.
We have to get it.
America appears to be in its hydration era. The reusable water bottle industry is worth $9 billion and expected to grow. The TikTok hashtag emotional support water bottle has more than 300 million views. But do we really need to tote around a 64-ounce tumbler to drink enough water? Today, as part of 1A's In Good Health series, we put your hydration questions directly to the experts. We get into hydration myths and separate the hype from the actual science. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Go fill up your water bottles. We've got a lot to get into.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
Joining us from Tulsa, Oklahoma, is Emily Cantois. She's here to tell us why everyone's talking about water bottles. Her recent piece for Time is called Your New Year's Resolution to Carry a Water Bottle Has a History. She's also a professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. Professor Cantois, welcome to 1A.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So you study the connection between food, gender, and ideas about our health. Why do you think the U.S. is so obsessed with hydration right now?
Hydration feels like a panacea, right? It's going to make our digestion work. We're going to have beautiful skin. We're going to meet our goals. We're going to be motivated, right? That we are just going to be the people we aspire to be. Hydration's become this thing we can focus on that makes us feel all those things we want to feel about ourselves.
Maybe someone listening isn't hearing a lot about water bottles. Where is this conversation or hype around water bottles happening right now?
So we're in a really like micro trend of the last 5 years of water bottles that are gigantic, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I was in college in the early 2000s, it was incredibly weird to walk around with a big water bottle. That was the age of, the Nalgene size, right? 16, 20 ounces. That was starting to become a cultural norm. But now my college students do. They have these gigantic water bottles, often in really beautiful colors, right? That you can choose a color combination, a beautiful, elegant cap, a particular design that says something about your personality that also has a little bit to do with fashion, at the same time that it speaks about your health goals, what you feel about the environment, that we really see the intersection of a lot of things happening as people choose their water bottles and carry them around with them. But we're at an interesting peak water bottle moment where the water bottles are really large and there's great enthusiasm for them.
Now, water bottles have been around for a century, and you write that it was once a sort of niche but kind of weird thing to do, to carry around a reusable water bottle. What's been the evolution of our relationship to these items in the U.S.?
Absolutely. So in the early 20th century, we start to have really good municipal water treatments, right? So the water coming out of your tap was for the first time really trustworthy. And so by the 20s, the 30s, water bottles, you know, were considered quote unquote low class, right? They were indicative of you living in a place where the water wasn't safe and that you needed to drink from a water bottle. So for much of the middle of the 20th century, water bottles, whether it's reusable ones, which aren't a thing yet, or buying plastic ones, that doesn't really come about. Brands like Perrier, for example, trying to make inroads into the United States in the 1980s. This is a part of the yuppie generation, right, that has, you know, consumer habits that go along with their ideas about health. And so buying these fancy waters align with that. And then as we go forward about another decade, those really cheap plastics, right, when you think about how lightweight, you know, a Dasani bottle or something like an Aquafina bottle is now, water becomes more affordable at a different price point with this lighter weight plastic. That's about technological developments and the actual plastics being used. But Nalgene was one of these first big brands in the reusable water bottle space, the special plastics that they were making. And it was actually people who worked at their company and then fellow sort of environmental enthusiasts who loved to go hiking, and they wanted to be able to pack in, pack out with no garbage. And so being able to have these reusable water bottles, those were for people who we might have called kind of crunchy, right? These were granola people. These were a niche group of people who loved the outdoors and really cared about nature. And so, of course, those environmental ethos will become much more important as we start to have the EPA, as we have an environmental movement in this country, and, of course, as we live in a moment now of climate crisis, climate change, and significant focus on our environment.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm thinking about the water bottles I see now, where it's the size of a small baby, and you know, yes, you have like the little lines on it to track. We'll drink this much by the morning, and this much by noon, and this much by five, and it's part of this datification of,
yes,
our life. How many steps are you taking? How many times have you stood up in the past hour? And I'm curious what you think about the way we've datified our lives and how it's connected to this question around hydration.
Absolutely. That those lines on the water bottle helping you to track it, there are apps, there are journals, right, to be tracking your water intake. That I think for some people, there comes this sense of security of knowing I've met my goal, right? It has a quantified meaning behind it. And there's that sense of security and sort of success that might go with that too. But my concern is that we might be losing touch with our bodies to simply listen and understand and know we've had enough, right? We've eaten enough. We've had enough to drink, right? That we feel confident and fine and well in our bodies, and that we can sense that. That I'm sure as you know, talk to our medical experts later on in the episode, you know, the advice is just to drink to thirst, right? When you're thirsty, go ahead and drink. But for some of us, that doesn't feel good enough. It doesn't feel like we're working hard enough, right? This optimization culture that goes along with these trends towards datification make it hard for some of us to feel confident that we can listen to our bodies and know we've drunk to thirst, we've done a good job, and everything's okay.
Now, reusable water bottles are so popular that there's now a market for water bottle accessories.
These cups attach to the side of your Stanley lid so you have a perfect spot for your favorite dipping sauces while on the go.
Professor Cantwell, what do you think this current wave of water bottle mania says about American culture more broadly?
I think it speaks to a lot of different things, but maybe the most important one is that focusing on something about our health gives us this sense of control that can be so meaningful when our social, cultural, political, economic environment feels like it's in chaos. And that's arguably been our last several years. When we look at politics, when we look at gun control, when we look at the climate, right, there are so many big things happening around us that seem so desperately out of our control, that focusing on water and our water bottle that is cute and colorful, and we can take it with us. It's there to support us in our goals, to support us in this, you know, happy, healthy life we're trying to have. It can give us that sense of control and peace that we're yearning for.
But it makes me wonder how water bottle companies are using marketing, whether it's social media or television, whatever, to influence the way we think about our health and to maybe play or capitalize on this feeling of insecurity.
Absolutely. I mean, I teach a course on the history of advertising, right? And for the last 100 years, this is what advertising does, right? Of tapping our insecurities and our hopes, often at the same time, and promising a product, right, to help us be able to deal with those emotions. And so health in the United States, you know, Robert Crawford wrote this incredibly influential piece on healthism, this idea that health is a super value in the United States, particularly for the American middle class. And so to be constantly pursuing good health is incredibly important to our understanding of who we are as a people.
We got this message from Dan in Wichita who says, something that doesn't make sense to me is that reusable water bottles are just that, reusable. So why is there such a large industry for them and so many new ones? I've used my Nalgene for at least a decade. What can you tell us?
Absolutely. So part of this is about collecting, about fashion, right? Fashion comes in and out. And then this desire to have lots of water bottles with this personalization piece. So part of this is about health. Part of it's about our care for the environment. But a lot of it is about our consumer culture. We live in an American culture where very often we're told that the way we spend our dollars, where we spend our dollars, is a part of how we can be civically engaged and impact the world. And that's a very easy message to get twisted into doing more by buying more. And so with the Stanleys, right, getting dropped and all these special edition, beautiful colors, that these are ways that we create feelings of scarcity, also feelings of specialness, of products that, you know, identify and relate to our own identities, personalities, you know, feelings about ourselves. And so wanting to just buy more and more, that we see, you know, people show their social media videos of, you know, dozens and dozens that they have. And I think with social media too, you know, a brand like Swell, right, that, you know, a metal bottle with sort of an elegant cap, you know, they come out almost in tandem with Instagram, right? And Instagram really brings with it that aesthetic set of rules that we should be representing life more beautiful than it actually is. And so to have a really pretty shaped and colored water bottle, you know, held with a manicured hand on your desk, nice and organized, right, became a way to represent a lifestyle. Water bottles got wrapped up in that Instagram aesthetic. And we see that continuing on TikTok.
Well, as I take a drink from my reusable water bottle, I have a lot to think about. That's Emily Cantois, a professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. We'll link to her recent article, Your New Year's Resolution to Carry a Water Bottle Has a History, on our website, the1a.org. Professor Cantois, thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
Coming up, you've probably heard the 8 glasses a day rule. Bottled water companies have long wanted you to make it a habit, but what do doctors say? We'll be back with more in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and t-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and t-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
Let's bring two new voices to the conversation. Tammy Hugh Butler is a professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University and a podiatrist specializing in sports medicine. Professor Hugh Butler, welcome to 1A.
Happy to be here.
And also with us is Dr. Mitchell Rosner, a nephrologist, that's a kidney specialist. He's also chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. Dr. Rosner, it's great to have you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And just a reminder, as always, our experts are not a replacement for seeing your own doctor. We got this email from Dave in Maryland who says, please don't forget to mention overhydration. Saw someone go down in a road race and found out later he was overhydrated. Professor Hugh Butler, when did you first notice overhydration becoming a problem for athletes?
I first saw this in 2000. So, you know, over 20 years ago, we were working at the finish line in the medical tent of the Houston Marathon. And, you know, runners were going down left and right, and it was a hot day. So everybody thought that they were dehydrated. And so, you know, it's most medical. Back then, what we did is we put in IVs and started thinking that they were dehydrated. And so we were giving them more water. And the runners, four of them, actually ended up having seizures in the medical tent and then being taken to the hospital, and they were in comas for a week. They all survived, thank goodness. But it came back that they had this condition called hyponatremia. And back then, we didn't know if they were drinking too much water and diluting their blood salt, or that they were actually losing too much salt. And so, you know, therein began this 15-year quest to find out that they were drinking too much water. So that's my introduction to overhydration.
Dr. Rosner, when you talk to your patients, what kind of understanding do they have of hydration and what it means to be hydrated?
Yeah, I think this is a question that's at the crux of the issue. One is there's no good definition of what hydration means. Going back to something that Tammy mentioned, you know, the 8 glasses, 8 ounces really goes back to the 1940s and a paper from the National Research Council that looked at dietary intakes. And they did say about 2 liters of fluid, but what was lost from that is the second part that Tammy alluded to, that a lot of that water, 25 to 50%, is actually in your food. But people want definitions. They want to know how much water to drink. And so I get that question all the time. How much is the right amount? How much is too much? And I think if I have to give an answer to that, what I generally tell patients is that for most patients, most people who are doing activities of daily living that are not exertional, not in extremes of temperature, that anywhere from 2 to 2.5 liters, which is a little bit more than 64 ounces, is going to be sufficient. And recognize that maybe 20% of that comes from your food. And the other thing that people ask is, well, how much urine should I make a day? How much is too little? And there's some studies that go back into the early 2000s and before that shows that generally, people have urine volumes anywhere between 1.5 to 2 liters. So if you drink 2 to 2.5 liters of fluid, you're probably going to maintain good hydration and not run into any difficulties.
Well, we got lots of comments from our audience about urine color. And I wonder, Dr. Rosner, is there anything we should note? Like if you drink a lot of water, your urine is going to tend to be lighter in color, a little more diluted. Is there something we should pay attention to there?
Yeah, this comes up again all the time. And I think at the extremes, it's probably a reasonable statement. So if your urine is clear, looks like water, you're probably well or even overhydrated. You're not having that pigment that's concentrated that gives the urine the color. On the other extreme, if your urine is really dark, has a strong odor, your urine's probably concentrated, and probably drinking some more fluids is reasonable. In between those extremes, it's really hard to tell, and it's probably not a very accurate way to use to judge your hydration.
We got this from Grace in Maryland, who writes, as someone who tends to have low blood pressure, I aim to drink 100 to 120 ounces of water or herbal teas and decaf coffee per day. What signs should I look for to know if I'm overhydrated? And Professor Hugh Butler, I drink, because I talk a lot during my day, I tend to drink a lot of water. It's just because my mouth gets dry, not because I'm feeling, you know, dehydrated. But are there any signs for overhydration that we can watch for?
What's interesting is that the signs and symptoms of dehydration are the same signs and symptoms of overhydration. So headache, you know, dizziness are big ones that we really can't tell. If you start to get puffy, that's a sign that we look for, that like maybe you're retaining the water. It was interesting that she was saying she drinks a lot of water to try to keep her blood pressure. But what's interesting there, and Mitch can chime in, is that, you know, that's usually related more to salt, because the balance is not exclusively about the water. It's about the balance between the salt and the water. But again, too, you know, the problem is, even in the medical tents, it's really hard to diagnose overhydration versus dehydration at a clinical level without a blood test. So the symptoms and signs to look out for, other than, you know, you're peeing a lot and you're getting puffy and, you know, headaches can come, those are some of the, like, okay, well, how much do you drink? But they get really, really blurred, and there's a lot of gray there. It's not what one distinct over the other.
Dr. Rosner, what can you add?
Yeah, I'd say maybe a couple of things is that I would ask people to be attuned to their bodies. So if they're drinking a lot of fluid and they begin to feel bloated, puffy, they're developing a headache, that's a sign that it's too much. You don't want to feel bloated. There's no need to sort of act like a camel and start storing water. That's a sign that you've just had too much. And be attuned to your body, how you feel. You know, one thing that Tammy and I both advocate strongly is that we have a great mechanism to tell when we need fluids, and that's our thirst. And if you respond to that thirst mechanism by drinking more fluids, in the vast, vast majority of cases, that's going to keep you well hydrated, keep your body functioning at its optimum, and you'll feel fine.
Professor Hugh Butler, we talked about there not being really a sort of scientific way to measure hydration, but is there a difference between thirst and dehydration?
Well, if you're looking at the true clinical diagnosis of cellular dehydration, your cells start to shrink. And so when you actually need water, before it gets too late, that kicks in a physiological response for you to actually get thirsty. And so that you will then refill the water that you need so that your cells remain nice and plump the way that they like to function. So it is a good indicator when your body needs a little more water, it's already retaining it. But I want to add to what we were talking about before. If you're drinking too much, it actually becomes painful. So, you know, there are mechanisms that try to prevent us against drinking too much water. But again, too, when you start to truly become a little bit like you're starting to lose more water where your cells are shrinking, you will get thirsty and try to, like, you know, gravitate towards anything that's going to actually bring those H2O molecules back into your body.
Well, and when you say drinking too much, it becomes painful, do you just mean the expansion of our stomachs, or is there some other warning?
So the brain scan studies show that actually the actual drinking of, like, swallowing the water becomes, yeah, and then it signals light up in the brain that actually are the same signals that light up as pain. So your body knows that if you're really trying to force it, it becomes very unpleasant, almost painful. So that, to me, is also a sign if you really have to try to force it. Yeah, that means you probably don't need it.
Dr. Rosner, are there times when our thirst may signal something other than dehydration?
Yeah, I think there are. So some examples would be there's some medications that make your mouth feel quite dry. Or if you're in a dry, arid environment, you know, in the southwest of the United States, in a desert environment, that dry air can make you feel thirsty because your mouth is so dry. And so there are circumstances where patients will note, or anybody will note, that their mouth feels dry, and that can give you a sensation of thirst, like you need to drink. So you have to be aware of those. I think most people sort of acclimatize to that and know how much to drink over time. And I think the likelihood in those circumstances of overdrinking and developing the condition that Tammy was talking about, hyponatremia, are pretty low. What we caution against is just forcing those fluids to the point where it does become uncomfortable.
We also got this email from George who asks, my physician recommended higher levels of hydration for me based on my blood tests and my diagnosis of grade 2 kidney disease. Are there situations where increased hydration is therapeutically warranted? Dr. Rosner, what can you tell us?
Yeah, there's some good data in this regard, and there's a couple of conditions that we do recommend more aggressive hydration, drinking 3 liters or maybe a little bit more than that. And those would be patients who have kidney stones. We know that diluting out the urine decreases the rate of kidney stones. There's some data that higher urine outputs and higher fluid intakes can be protective against bladder cancer. People who have repeat urinary tract infections, they often find that they also can dilute their urine and urinate more frequently, and drinking excess fluids can help them with that. And then around the question that was asked here, there's a little bit of data that higher water intakes can slow the progression of chronic kidney disease. That's especially true for certain types of kidney disease. One in particular is polycystic kidney disease. But the data for other forms of chronic kidney disease and the relationship to water intake isn't as clear.
Well, let's take a quick pause here. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Macmillan Audio. Following 10 years of reporting experience in the Middle East, 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas L. Friedman penned one of the most thought-provoking works about the region ever written, From Beirut to Jerusalem. The audiobook, now available unabridged for the first time and featuring a new preface read by the author, is filled with information that will continue to shape how people view the Middle East for years to come. Find From Beirut to Jerusalem wherever audiobooks are sold.
Let's get back to the conversation with this message we got from Sophie, who says, my fiancé insists that diet sodas like Diet Coke, Diet Dr. Pepper are the second most hydrating drink you can consume after water. We need someone to settle this debate once and for all. Dr. Rosner, you're on the hot seat. Is diet soda the second most hydrating drink you can consume after water?
Yeah, I have to say I haven't heard that one. There have been some studies that look at different fluids and in terms of how well they lead to hydration. Again, it depends upon what definition you use for hydration, and that can be quite difficult. In that study, actually, milk turned out to be one of the most hydrating fluids. And the reason it was in that case is that when you have some fluids that do have nutritional value, those fluids slow gastric emptying, and there's more time while that fluid is in the stomach to be absorbed. I don't think we could say that would be true for a diet soda. So I'd be skeptical of that claim. And again, I think when you get down to adding additives or things that we know maybe aren't the most healthful for your body, drinking lots of those fluids may not be the best decision. And water is probably still the most accessible, easiest, safest way to hydrate yourself.
Now, Professor Hugh Butler, you're a runner. If you're going out to exercise, how do you determine how much water to drink before or even after?
So for those individuals who like a quantity or like kind of like need to plan rather than judging on thirst, what we recommend is standing on a scale, see what your body weight is, and then running for an hour and then coming back and then weighing yourself again. And then calculating how much weight that you lost is how much that you would need to replace. And so that's how runners and athletes who really like to have a number, we can generate a baseline ballpark of how much you would need to drink during your exercise session or your run.
So not so much trying to prehydrate to prepare for the workout, but thinking more about replacing water that you may have lost while you were sweating during that workout.
Correct.
And what about if you get to the other end of a workout, you don't have a scale handy, and you don't feel particularly thirsty? Should you still make a point to try to drink something? You sweated a lot, but yeah, my mouth feels fine.
I mean, I think we call that topping up. And so even where you're talking about prehydration, you know, it's okay to top up even if you're not thirsty or don't have a scale after you exercise, because you will retain the water that you need and you will pee out the excess. So unless you're completely forcing water down, it's okay to drink a little bit even if you're not thirsty, and just, you know, see what your body needs, and it will discard what it doesn't.
Well, we heard from Patty in Bloomington, Minnesota, who texted, I used to think 64 ounces of water a day was the benchmark, which was challenging but doable. Then I read half an ounce per pound of weight, which was way too much for me. I had to run to the bathroom every hour or more. Dr. Rosner, is there some calculation we should be using to figure out how much to drink?
Not that I know of, and I think Tammy alluded to this earlier, too. There's really no good studies, and it's really individual. It depends upon your body weight, your activity, the temperature that you're working in. And so we can give people rough guides of around 2 liters. But then I think it really comes down to individualizing your water intake based upon how you feel. With the caveat, don't force the water. Don't force yourself to bloating to where you feel that you're getting puffy. Drink to your thirst when it's available. But then just be sensible about how much water you're drinking every day.
We got a lot of messages from people asking about liquids from tea or coffee. One of you texted, how much water do I drink? Not enough. I often find myself at work feeling tired, drink a cup of coffee, but not feeling awake until I drink a cup of cool water afterwards. What role does caffeine play in our ability to absorb the water that's, say, in a cup of coffee or tea? Dr. Rosner?
Yeah, so the issue with caffeinated beverages is that caffeine will act as a diuretic to stimulate your urine output. So cc for cc, milliliter per milliliter, a caffeinated beverage is not going to hydrate you as well as water. It will offer some hydration that's going to be quite variable depending upon how much urine you make, but that caffeine will have a diuretic effect and stimulate more urine output, and that's going to lessen the hydrating effect of the tea or the coffee.
I want to focus on electrolytes for a moment. Professor Hugh Butler, you're an athlete. You work with athletes to understand proper hydration and electrolyte balance. How has marketing around sports drinks changed the average person's perception of their electrolyte and hydration needs?
The marketing has influenced particularly athletes that they need to replace particularly sodium on the spot. And there is some evidence if you sweat a lot of sodium or particularly if it's really hot outside that that electrolyte, particularly sodium replacement, is advantageous. But for the most part, again, it's like it's not one size fits all. And most of the studies will show we are able to replace the electrolytes and minerals that we need in the next meal. And it doesn't have to be replaced on the spot. But a lot of the sports drinks markets that you need this if you're playing sports. So it adds some confusion. Will it, is it going to hurt you? Probably not. But is it going to help you? Probably not.
We got this message from Saul who writes, I carry a water bottle around like many people because water fountains have been taken away from a lot of places, replaced with vending machines with water bottles. We spoke with Jossie Ivanov, a city planner who's researched the decline of water fountains in the U.S., and she says many Americans express skepticism about public water sources, and that reflects on an underlying attitude about distrust of the government and public infrastructure. How do each of you think disappearing water fountains are a public health concern? Dr. Rosner?
Yeah, I'm certainly not an expert on this topic, and I think it's a good point that listeners have brought up. Ideally, everybody has access to clean water that's of a good source and is going to be healthy for us, and I think that would be a wonderful goal for all municipalities to have, so that everybody had that access. I can certainly sympathize with people who don't feel that they do have that. And I think that's a very reasonable reason to carry a water bottle or occasionally to have to buy bottled water that you feel more comfortable with. So I can completely sympathize with that. And, I think it's a great goal for us to make sure that the water supply that people have access to is safe and healthy.
Well, I want to get to one more message. We got this from another caller.
Hi, this is Sam. I'm calling from Baltimore. My father has a neurological disability that is having, among other effects, leading to a lack of him drinking enough water. And so abnormalities in the urine, et cetera. And along with that neurological disability, the old tool of, hey, keep a water bottle with you all the time doesn't really work. So I'm wondering what other thoughts there are out there about how to provide hydration for people in a position where they don't have that natural instinct to lug around the Nalgene with them. Thank you.
Dr. Rosner, any thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great point. And you see this often in patients with advanced dementia, unfortunately, where they don't have ready access to water. Either they're immobilized or they have neurological disease, which blunts that thirst and their inability to go up and get water. And I think in those circumstances, several things can be done. One is to ensure that they're being offered water frequently, to measure how much water they're taking in, to look at their urine output, and in those cases, to check blood work to make sure that the signs in the body's electrolytes are in balance and their kidney function is being maintained with the amount of fluid we're giving them. Unfortunately, in some cases, we have to either provide IV fluids or occasionally we have to use feeding tubes or other ways to keep patients hydrated when they don't have that ability. But that's certainly a separate circumstance, but one where really thoughtfulness and attention to the detail of the needs of that particular patient really are very important.
Well, we'll leave it there. That's Dr. Mitchell Rosner. He's a nephrologist and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. And Tammy Hugh Butler, a professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University in Detroit. She's also a podiatrist specializing in sports medicine. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Anna Casey. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the NPR Wine Club. Get the world of wine delivered to your door. When you join the NPR Wine Club, you'll receive the stories behind every bottle and favorite NPR shows and personalities arriving in liquid form, like Weekend Edition Cabernet and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Zinfandel. The NPR Wine Club is a delicious way to support NPR's programming. If you're 21 or older, uncork a special offer at nprwineclub.org/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Leesa.com to learn more. That's Leesa.com.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.